Hello everyone, it's Beverly Tomasian. I am really excited to welcome you to our CDE Exam Boot Camp 6. We've been through a lot of material and we're kind of coming to the culmination. We have a few boot camps left, but this is kind of a main part of the boot camp, looking at medical nutrition therapy and exercise. It really is the foundation for diabetes care and education. So you could say we saved the best for last, and let's just move on. I hope you all have your handouts with you. And on your resource page, we did put a very important document called the Exchange List. And I also posted on your resource page on the exercise guidelines. So there's review the Exchange List is what I'm asking you to do if you are getting ready for the exam. You want to review the ADA standards of care in two particular areas, and I have these articles posted on your resource page. The nutrition guidelines are from 2013, but they're the most current guidelines out there. You could either look at them on this article that I have in your resource page, or you could look at the ADA standards of care for a condensed version. But if you're not that familiar with nutrition therapy, I would read the full version. There's also a position statement I have on exercise and type 2 diabetes. It's a detailed summary of why they've come up with the exercise recommendations they have. So if exercise is kind of new for you, I would read through it. It's a really great resource. And of course, if you have the Art and Science book, there's chapters on that information also. But these, the American Diabetes Association, in my opinion, I find them very well written and condensed information that I can get in a shorter read. The Art and Science book, to me, is very well written, but it's voluminous. So if my time is limited, I might read through these first and then fill in the blanks with the Art and Science content too. Here's the CDE outline on medical nutrition therapy and exercise. So in your exam handbook for the CDE, they list what you need to know about all these different topic areas. And so I'm putting this here. It's in your handbook. I've posted the outline on our resource page. But you might want to take a look at what particular areas they want you to be familiar with for the exam. And I've kind of structured my outline to cover these key content areas. This is a great checklist for you to see, am I familiar with all of these different bullet points per se. So let's move on to food. One of my favorite topics, but just like our patients, I'm just going to say for myself, keeping our weight at target, keeping that BMI below 25 is a real struggle. And our patients struggle with it every day. And they know there's a lot on the line. They know they have diabetes. They want to get their blood sugars down for a lot of reasons, to get their blood pressure down, to get their cholesterol under control, to get their blood sugars. So they know how valuable weight loss is. And they know they're going to feel better and their clothes are going to fit better, but still, we struggle with weight loss, and that's a global phenomenon. We can get it off many times, but keeping it off is also a struggle. In America, we are getting heavier. I just want to show you two charts here. And this was from, it was from a journal, a cancer journal, that I found these stats, because we know that cancer and obesity go together, and diabetes and obesity go together. But you can see obesity in America, here's the BMI, here's over time. If you have less than a high school education, those are some of the heaviest people we have. But the college people, the super smart, are getting heavier too, just at a slower rate. We have about a 10-year lag. But over time, Americans are getting heavier, and that might be in one reason it might be due to is the fact that we're eating more calories. In 1970, on average, we ate about 2,000 calories a day. Over here to 2010, we're eating about 2,600 calories a day. So 600 extra calories a day adds up, and it explains in part why we're so heavy. 68% of Americans are overweight or obese. 34% of them are obese with a BMI of 30 or greater. 34% of them are overweight with a BMI of 25 to 30. Just because you're overweight doesn't mean you're going to get diabetes. One third of all overweight people don't get it. You have to have the genetics to get diabetes. We move less at work. We know that. We're sitting 9.5 hours on average a day. If you think about how much your grandmother sat, she didn't sit much at all. She was moving constantly. And so in America today, We have a lot more sit-down desk jobs, and that's really wreaking havoc on our health. Overall, food is costing less relative to income. So food has gotten cheaper over time. Its food is more industrialized, and so if it costs less, people tend to eat more. That's one of the theories. And we're eat more calories every day. Here's a BMI chart, and I thought this is a nice visual image. I've shown this before, but underweight BMI, less than 17. Here's a normal BMI. Once we get over 25, we're moving into overweight. BMI of 30 or greater is obesity. So you can see that extra weight just clings to the middle area, also known as visceral adiposity or abdominal fat. And that's where the increase in insulin resistance comes in. I think this is a really nice chart to show our patients too if they're trying to figure out where they are on the BMI scale. And I just put in here a BMI chart with ranges. I don't think you can probably see it on your handout. It's very small, but I would encourage you to print out a BMI chart. You can just get this, you can Google BMI charts and have it in your office. And when my patients come in, I look at their height and weight and I calculate a BMI and I share that with them. And I'll say, you're here. This is kind of the goal. Where we're at our best health, just to give you a perspective. And then we start doing some goal setting based on that. But patients are familiar with BMI, they just don't know what it means, so I kind of translate that over for them. So medical nutrition therapy, American Diabetes Association 2015. Now I have the date 2015, but the real revolution in how the ADA presents medical nutrition therapy started in 2013 in December. They published their new guidelines. So I'm really just talking about these guidelines, but they are reiterated in the 2015 standards of care. And the first thing is this first bullet point, which is, it's been around for a while, but I still struggle with what to do with this information. There's no ideal percentage of calories from protein, carbohydrate, and fat for people with diabetes. Before, we used to say, you know, try and get about 20% of your calories from protein, 50% from carb, and 30% from fat. We can't even say that anymore because it's individualized based on the patient, their blood pressure, their cultural preferences, their access to food, their cholesterol, did I say that, and their blood sugars. So we have to individualize everything. There's no one way of doing it all for patients. And so we're going to have to really focus on individualizing our goals based on where they're at. And I'm not a dietitian. I'm a registered nurse and a certified diabetes educator. But even so, I need to know a lot about nutrition. It's part of my scope of practice as a certified diabetes educator. So no matter what profession we are, nutrition therapy is really important. And so we have to have this baseline knowledge. And that's why I feel comfortable teaching this, because I'm not a dietitian, but I am a CDE. And as a CDE, I am responsible to know a lot about nutrition therapy because my patients are going to ask me. While I've said that, I also want to say that my colleagues who are registered dietitians are somebody I refer to constantly all the time. Anyone who comes to see me for diabetes education is seen by our registered dietitians, and that's a covered benefit. So I understand my role is to provide information, but also to reach out to the RD, who is an expert in this field, to provide more intensive education. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Evidence-Based Nutrition Practice Guidelines. What they say is that a person with diabetes should have a series of 3 to 4 encounters lasting from 45 to 90 minutes. The encounter should begin at the diagnosis of diabetes, or at first referral should be completed within 3 to 6 months. The RD should determine whether additional MNT encounters are needed, and at least one follow-up encounter is recommended annually to reinforce lifestyle changes and monitor outcomes. Our meeting with a registered dietitian is amazing. It drops A1C 1 to 2 percentage points. More 1% with type 1s, 2% more with type 2s. So if you think about our best medications drop A1C 2 percentage points. So seeing a dietitian is as effective as starting a medication. Wait, I want to say one more thing, because I get my knickers in a twist about this. Only 9% of people who are eligible to see a dietitian see them. 9%. 1 out of 10. that should be 99.9%. I mean, if you can get to the dietitian's office, we should have you see one because they are so effective at helping people change your relationship to food. It's really because there has to be a paradigm shift with the person and their relationship with food and eating and moving toward a more healthier style of eating. Final regulation for medical nutrition therapy, what Medicare covers. Could this be on the exam? Absolutely. We need to know that for MNT, Medicare covers 3 hours in the first calendar year of medical nutrition therapy. 3 hours. That's amazing. And then they cover 2 hours follow-up annually. To be reimbursed, the program must be ADA or AADE recognized, and we need to code for medical nutrition therapy for diabetes and also for kidney disease. Dietitians can be covered for both of those. That's a great benefit that we're not taking advantage of. So the next on the checklist from the CDE exam outline is that we want to assess knowledge, self-management skills, and eating patterns. So we look at eating patterns, we want to look at their preferences, a portion size, timing, snacks, eating environment, and disordered eating. There's a lot of things we want to summarize. And here's the Thanksgiving meal. What is the only food at this Thanksgiving meal that's not a carbohydrate? The turkey. Although the wine isn't either, so okay, we'll have to count the wine and the turkey. I've been saying this a lot. I know you're all thinking, what about the green beans? The green beans are virtually free. You're absolutely right. So I love this quote by Oscar Wilde, "Be yourself, everyone else is already taken." I love that picture. It's so great. And so when we think about diabetes education and providing skills for eating healthfully and exercising, we really need to consider the individual. And if I could say something about the exam, this is what the exam's all about. It's a philosophical underpinning. Consider the individual and empower them to help them change behavior. Of course, knowing me, I threw in a new poll question that's not in your handout, but it's okay. We'll just go with it. But I just had to add it because I feel like it's such an important concept. Mary has newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes. Her BMI is 31 and her A1C is 7.3. She wants to learn how to adjust her eating habits to lower her blood glucose. Where would you start? A, would you focus on the importance of counting carbs and not exceeding 45 grams per meal? B, encourage her to avoid all junk food and sugary drinks. C, provide her information on 1200 calorie diet, or D, assess her usual eating habits and preferences. So where would you start? So that's the main kind of crux of this question. So I'll go ahead and launch the poll and see what you think. Okay, everybody. Nobody's going for my juicy answers. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. One more vote. Okay, let me share this. Well, you all got the answer correct. D, assess her usual eating habits and preferences. So you know what this tells me, looking at your results, that you guys are really getting ready for this exam. You're having a significant understanding about not imposing rules on people, not telling people what to do, but we need to assess and start where they're at. So great job, Team Boot Camp. Great job. Approach depends on the patient. New type 2s, we're going to look at portion control, plate method, record keeping, education. What if they're on insulin? If they're on insulin, we really need to consider carb counting and matching that to insulin. But some patients may benefit from a simpler approach. So even on insulin therapy, what if they're type 1? Yeah, carb counting is best and adjusting your insulin based on blood sugars and what you're going to eat. But some patients may have real trouble coping and we may need to simplify things. We just start where the person is at. This came right out of the standards of care. It's standard number 4. This is a great slide to put a big star on. Goals of Medical Nutrition Therapy, ADA. Promote and support healthful eating patterns. promote and support healthful eating patterns. A. Emphasize eating a variety of nutrient-dense foods in appropriate portions. Oh, so portion control, healthy food. Why do we want to do that? We want to look at attaining individualized blood pressure, blood glucose, and lipid goals. We want to help maintain body weight goals and then delay or prevent complications. So we always want to give patients a reason to do things. Like, we're really trying to help you, you know, eat differently so you can have a better life outcome, so you can live healthier, and so we can help get your blood pressure, glucose, and lipids to target. The next one, address individual nutrition needs based on personal and cultural preferences, access to food, willingness, and barriers. Wow, these are really well done. I mean, they've really thought about what's realistic in the world we live in. And the diabetes world is complex. Patients bring in a lot of baggage when they come to see us, and in terms of their relationship with food, their history with losing weight and gaining weight. There's a lot of emotions associated with food. I don't need to tell all of you that. Look at this. Maintain pleasure of eating by providing positive messages about food. I love this. Limit food choices only when backed by science. I used to give out, I think I've mentioned this, a tear sheet with all the foods people with diabetes should not eat. This was 30 years ago. We don't do that anymore. It's not backed by science. The last one, provide practical tools for day-to-day planning rather than focusing on individual macronutrients. So really moving away from, you know, percent of carbs, protein, and fat, and saying, how can we help you on a day-to-day basis to attain your goals that will help you move toward health? Okay, so now let's talk about sodium, fat, and fiber. Would I know this? Yeah, I would know these. Sodium, for all people with or without diabetes, they decided just to keep it one level, sodium, 2,300 milligrams a day. And we might have to modify that. African Americans with diabetes may need less sodium, they're more sodium sensitive, or people with hypertension, we might need to adjust that, but we need to individualize it. Vitamin and mineral supplements, not recommended. There's lack of evidence. So a lot of my patients spend a ton of money on vitamins and minerals, and if they ask me, what do you think, I'll say, you know what, the science doesn't back that up, but if you can afford that and that makes you feel better, I'm okay with it as long as it's safe. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a big controversy right now with the FDA that they're not inspecting these nutraceuticals. And so sometimes we don't know what we're taking. So that's the caveat I would also share with them. Fat intake, same as recommended for the general population. Less than 10% saturated fat. That used to be 7%. So if you have memorized 7, let go of it, it's 10%. Limit trans fat. This is for all people and people with diabetes. And less than 300 milligrams of cholesterol daily. Mediterranean and more plant-based diets look like a good option. And then fiber, 25 to 38 grams a day. That's a big jump. Most Americans are eating about 15 grams a day. So we're going to really, I'm going to go back a slide, really try and encourage our people to, you know, get those fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains. A little fiber goes a long way as far as increasing your sense of satiety, and of course, helping your intestine repopulate with good bacteria that support health. ADA recommendation, eat less junk food and sugary drinks. This is from the ADA. Eat less processed foods, less sugary beverages. They're thinking that sugary beverages increase visceral adiposity, and that's with sugar or high fructose corn syrup. And the American Diabetes Association came out for the first time this year supporting a tax on sodas. So they're a very conservative body, and they're saying, we need to do something about this. So this is exciting. And in California, they're working on getting legislation passed that all sodas would have a warning, can cause obesity and contribute to diabetes. So there's a lot of momentum moving this forward, that we're in a public health crisis. And do people need all this soda? Probably not. New York to ban soft drinks larger than 16 ounces. So here's this guy with two sodas, 12 ounces, so he can beat the ban. I don't think it's really benefiting him, to be honest. Teaching about healthy eating. So there's different ways that we can teach about healthy eating. If they're type 2, they're overweight, we can talk about all of these. So I'll go over these individually. But here's the myplate.gov. And myplate.gov came out within the last few years. So they're saying a quarter of your plate should be whole grains, a quarter protein, vegetables and fruits, and then a glass of milk. And so a lot of us have modified this plate, myself included. And what I say is load up this side with lots of vegetables, have some whole grains, and it doesn't have to be meat-based protein, it can be plant-based protein, and then have a fruit on the side. Do we have to have milk at every meal? Well, it really depends on the patient and their calcium intake and needs. MyPlate.gov. Enjoy your food, but eat less. Avoid oversized portions. There's a gentleman in Japan who's invented glasses that makes your food look bigger, so you eat less. Just use a smaller plate. There's lots of studies that show if you use a 9-inch plate instead of the huge plates that we use, people lose weight. Switch to fat-free or low-fat milk and look at your sodium. Drink water instead of sugary drinks. And then here's another plate example. You can go online and look at it. Just look at plate method. You'll get a bunch of them. I love this one because, like I've said, it's got half the plate full of these beautiful, colorful vegetables, full of fiber and macronutrients and phytonutrients. Let me see, micronutrients and phytonutrients. Plus, it has this arroz y frijoles, which are, beans, another superfood, and then this 3-ounce portion of chicken, and this could be a plant-based protein too. And then it has on the side this beautiful orange, and it's a 9-inch plate, plato de 9 pulgadas, so 9 inches plate, and this beautiful glass of water. And actually, in this water, I'm going to throw a slice of cucumber or a raspberry or a slice of orange to glam it up and make it a little more sexy. Can we make water sexy? You better believe we can. Mindful eating. I just wrote a newsletter on mindfulness and I came across this plate. And I do this with a lot of my patients. I'm saying be aware. Tasting versus mindless munching. Savor the flavor. Is it crunchy, sweet, salty? Observe your body. Is it rumbling? Is your stomach full? Are you satisfied? Is it okay to stop eating now? Be in the moment. Be fully present when you eat. Sit down. When you eat, just eat. And let's try not to judge ourselves too much. Even when we're having those special treat foods, a lot of our patients are like, "I can't believe I'm eating this. This is so wrong." I go, "If you're going to have that special food, just sit down, eat, and really enjoy it. It's a gift. It's a special treat." So we can talk about the science of food, but there's so much emotional overtones with eating. I like to bring up this mindful eating platter too. So nutrition content from the CDE outline, we're going to look at carbs, fats, protein, food label interpretation, and food and medication integration. So let's just take a look how the different macronutrients affect the blood sugar. So we have three macronutrients, our carbohydrates, our protein, and our fat. It's the carbohydrate that really causes blood sugar to go up. And you can see here's 1 hour, so within 15 minutes of eating, the blood sugar spikes. Around the 1 hour mark, it's coming down. And so that's why we ask people to check their blood sugar 1 to 2 hours after a meal. Because by 1 to 2 hours after, the spike should have been concluded. Is that true for all meals? No. What if I eat pizza that has a lot of fat in it? That spike might be delayed. And so I'll see the blood sugar is going up later. It's not always the same every meal, but what if I just had like beans and rice and some fruit. I might just see a spike up because it was lower in fat. And so everybody responds differently to food depending on their gastric emptying, what else is in their food, if they have gastroparesis and all kinds of stuff. But generally speaking, it's the carbohydrate that raises blood sugar. What about protein? Protein really doesn't impact blood sugar that much. As a matter of fact, you can see here a little bit later, there's a little spike, but it never pushes the blood sugar above 110. There's some thought that protein actually increases insulin release. Here's fat. Really not much impact on blood sugars, but you can see it's absorbed later on, 3 to 4 hours, so it might delay absorption of other nutrients too, if it's a combined food or a food high in fat. And so all these factors go in to figuring out blood sugars, so it's complicated. But the thing that most affects post-meal blood glucose are the carbohydrates. And I do want to say, as I've mentioned before, there's no ideal amount of daily carb intake. We know that, so it's so hard. What do we do with this information? We just have to keep individualizing. However, monitoring carb intake and available insulin are key strategies for post-meal blood glucose. This comes right from the standards of care. So we do talk about how much carbs are you eating and how much insulin is floating around in your bloodstream, and do you have enough insulin to really store those carbohydrates? If you don't have enough available insulin and you eat more carbs, your blood sugars will end up being elevated. So we're trying to balance out insulin, carbs, to get blood sugars to target. So let's do another poll question. Mary can't figure out why her blood glucose always spikes after breakfast. How many grams of carbohydrate is in the following breakfast? 1 cup of oatmeal, 1/2 cup of milk, 3/4 cups of berries, and 2 eggs with salsa. Is it A, 57 grams, B, 36 grams, C, 51 grams, or D, 37 grams? I'm going to go ahead and launch this poll. Now, if you're not a dietitian, how would you know how many grams of carb are in these meals? Well, you would have to be familiar with the exchange list. So on the exam, they are going to require you to be familiar with some basic foods. And I would kind of put these in the basic food categories, that you should be familiar with oatmeal, fruits, salsa, all that stuff. Eggs, you know, what category of food are they in and how much carbohydrate does each of these food groups contain? And so on your resource list, I posted that exchange list that you can download and take a look at. Okay. So 65% of you have voted. So take your best guess. All right. So would they ask this kind of question in the test? Yeah, they would. And so, because as I've mentioned before, we need to know how to match insulin to carbs, so you need to be familiar with carb exchanges to do that. Okay, I'm going to close the poll. Thank you, everyone, for voting. I'm going to share your answers. So 31% of you chose 57 grams, 6% of you chose 36, 56% of you chose 51, and the remainder said 37 grams. So the correct answer is what the majority of you chose, and that is 51 grams. Good job. So if you didn't get that right, like what I always say is that's okay. You know, just it gives you information about what to study for the exam. And so let's just go over this together. So 1 cup of oatmeal is 30 grams. 1/2 cup of milk. So 1 cup of milk is 12 grams. So 1/2 cup is 6 grams. 3/4 cups of berries is 1 serving of berry or 15 grams. Eggs are protein. We don't count that. And salsa is free. It's considered a condiment and it's mostly tomatoes. So we don't consider that in the carb counting. So we come up to 51 grams of carbohydrate. So good job, you guys. That's just a little example of how to prepare for this part of the exam. Okay, now I have this that I put in here. Sometimes my patients will say, Bev, just tell me how many grams of carbs should I eat per meal? And so this is kind of a common approach to how many grams of carb per meal that I will use if patients really want to nail it down. Some people need very precise information. This is not going to be on the exam. This is just for you guys, okay? So 45 to 60 grams, you know, if they're athletic and a male and they're tall, we're going to go up higher, 75, 90 grams. But this is just general. And that this is each meal. So they get 3 to 4 servings each meal. And then if they're having snacks, most of my patients are trying to lose weight. So I say if you're going to have a snack, just try and stick to 15 grams. The RDA says, the recommended daily allowances, say you should at least eat 130 grams of carbohydrate per day. That's the minimum. And sometimes if I'm worried about a patient doing carb deprivation, and I'm sure you've met those people, they're eating less and less carbs to get their blood sugars down. I kind of count up how much carbs they're eating a day. And less than 130 is pretty low, but I have a lot of patients eating even less than that. So that prompts me to have a discussion with them saying, is there any way we can look at this a little bit differently? Because I'm worried you're not getting a lot of good nutrition by doing so much carbohydrate deprivation. It's tricky. So here's a diabetes exchange list. You can see one serving of starch has 15 grams. It has protein. So starch does contain protein and a trace fat. It's negligible. Lean meats, no carbohydrates, but they do contain protein and fat. Vegetables have some carbohydrate. The non-starchy we usually consider free, but if you eat a lot of them, we are going to consider it a starch. So let me just tell you the definition of free. Any carbohydrate less than 5 grams per serving is considered free. So that's how we come up with that. A fruit is 15 grams of carbohydrate per serving. Milk, 12 grams, and it has a variety of fat content depending on the type of milk, but the protein is steady at 8 grams. So that's just kind of a general schematic I would be familiar with for the exam. Now here's carb counting of starch. So I put this little presentation together, and actually a dietitian colleague of mine put this together. Her name is Sarah. And I said, can I steal this slide? It's so awesome. And she's like, yeah, great. So here it is. I just want to point out a few things. 1/3 cup of pasta is 15 grams or one serving. Not very much. That's cooked pasta. Half a cup of beans, 1/3 of a cup of cooked rice. These are really good portions to know. A small potato is not evil. A lot of my patients tell me, the doctor said no more potatoes. They're not bad. They're a starch. It's okay. They're not, they say all white food don't eat. Well, jicama's white. Small potatoes are white. I mean, they're okay. Just don't want to go crazy on them. Half English muffin, and then those are just all one servings of starch. And then here's fruit. So a small fruit is generally a serving of starch, half a cup of juice, that's really good to know for the exam. 1 1/4 cup of strawberries is a serving, and then 2 tablespoons of raisins, 17 small grapes. These all equal the same amount of carbohydrate as one slice of bread. Here's milk. Milk has 12 grams of carbohydrate. It's a general rule that we use, but of course, if you eat a yogurt, with sugar in it, it's going to have a lot more carb than that. But just milk on its own with the lactose sugar has about 12 grams. And a lot of patients think soy milk is free. No, it has carbohydrate. So 8 ounces is 12 grams. So diet hot cocoa, 12 grams, plain yogurt. So these are just serving sizes that might help you. These are some real common serving sizes if you're not familiar with the exchange list that you can memorize. That would be a good idea. And then here's carb counting for sweets. Half a cup of Jell-O, 1/2 cup of diet pudding. Now look, a lot of people say, oh, I eat sorbet, it's better for me than ice cream. Well, actually, 1/4 cup of sorbet is 15 grams versus 1/2 cup of ice cream. And so patients may say, well, I'd rather have the diet pudding and eat more than having regular Jell-O that has sugar in it. Like you could eat, sugar-free Jell-O and eat a lot of it. But some people don't like the taste of that sugar-free. They just rather eat the Jell-O and enjoy the flavor. And so I'm more of the mind to not use artificial sweeteners currently with the research that's being done. I'm advising my patients, if you can, I would just stick with the regular food and eat less of it. Well, speaking about sugar, the average American consumes 25 teaspoons of sugar a day. 400 of their calories come from sugar. And even the World Health Organization has got on board with this and said, we should really try and limit our sugar intake to 5 teaspoons a day, especially for our kids, because it's contributing to global obesity, tooth problems, increasing risk of other chronic conditions. And do we really need all that sugar? Probably not. It doesn't really have any, nutritional benefit other than providing calories. One soda has 12 teaspoons of sugar. I was in the airport the other day, and this gal was drinking a soda, and it was like a 20-ouncer. And I calculated that soda had 20 teaspoons of sugar. That's just shocking. On average, one person consumes 40 gallons of soda a year. A person who drinks a 20-ounce soda a day reduces their life expectancy by a few years. It seems like the soda shortens the telomeres in the cell, which contributes to, or what's the word? Which helps us determine life expectancy. So I can go on and on about sodas, but you guys already know all that. So I'm really trying to reach out to our people, to our patients, and talk about this big problem. I'm going to say one more thing, then I'll move on. I was in a park the other day, and I was talking to this mother. She had a 1.5 year old little girl with her, and the daughter was sick, and she was holding a Sprite in one of her hands and drinking that Sprite. And so you can see how the manifestation of unhealthy eating starts at a young age, not even by the child's choice, by what the parents choose. So reaching out to the parents, really important. Caloric sweeteners. So there's nutritive sweeteners. That means they offer calories. Sucrose or sugar does not increase glucose more than the same amount of starch. So we used to think, well, sugar's worse. It raises your blood sugar more than, the same amount of starch. No, sugar will raise your blood sugar as much as a piece of bread. But the bread hopefully offers more nutrients, fiber, and other things than this sugar does. Sugar's okay to include in a meal plan, but avoid excess intake. Fructose as sweetener not recommended since it may adversely affect your lipids. Natural fructose is okay. So a lot of these things that say sugar-free, they're sweetened with fructose. Not recommended because of the lipid impact. But fructose found in fruit is okay. So there's reduced calorie sweeteners. So they'll say sugar-free, but they'll have sugar alcohol to sweeten it. And these sugar alcohols still have calories, but they're not completely absorbed, so less calories. They do cause unpleasant side effects like diarrhea, bloating, and gas. So you'll see that patients on these sugar-free candies that are sweetened with sugar alcohols really do have a lot of excessive gas in many situations, so they stop eating them. Now, there's non-nutritive sweeteners. What does this mean? There's no calories associated with them. The FDA has six approved for use. They're 200 to 600 times sweeter than sugar. And the FDA stance currently is that no indication they will cause weight loss or weight gain. Safe for public, people with diabetes, and pregnant women. But as you know, there's a lot of controversy about this, and I believe the person in charge of the FDA is stepping down. We're going to get some new leadership. So I just want to say that I'm not sure if that's accurate, so just hold on to that statement. I'm going to double check it. I just want to say that generally for my patients, based on the research I'm seeing, as I've mentioned, I'm going to say steer away from those, try and just eat the regular food with less of these non-nutritive sweeteners. We want our patients to choose healthy carbs. We're going for 25 grams of fiber a day, and we want them to get the fiber from the power carbs, including beans, veggies, fruit, whole grain foods, because they're full of vitamins, minerals, and phytonutrients. And I love this picture of this face because you can see it has a variety of vegetables and fruits, and you can see how colorful they are. And we know that each different colored fruit offers a different type of micronutrient. So enjoy the abundance that nature offers us. And I'm going to tell you, this is an amazing thing that happens in my office. I have this list of 10 superfoods, and you guys can print it out and give it to your patients. And patients come in, they say, "I don't know what to eat." And I go, "Here are 10 superfoods. These are recommended by the American Diabetes Association. I want you to include these in your diet." And it feels like I'm giving them a gift. And they're like, "Really? I can have sweet potatoes, berries? These are good for me?" I'm like, "Yes." Of course, when it comes to the nuts, I'm going to talk about portion control because nuts are calorie dense. They are really healthy for you, but they do have calories associated with them. So if you're going to eat nuts, just a handful at a time. And don't have them just sitting out and open where you can munch on them. Really eat them deliberately. And so patients love getting this handout. I'm always surprised how much joy it gives them, because we're not taking something away. We're saying enjoy these foods. The other thing the American Diabetes Association wants us to do is help patients read labels. Labels are confusing, and they're working on new legislation for a more simple label. It's been stalled, but gosh, I'm hoping it's going to come out soon. So a serving size is a half a cup. Servings per container on this particular food are four. So serving size is really important for patients to know because lots of times they'll say 2 tablespoons and it's like, 3 cups of product. So they need to know serving size. And then we're going to go down to look at the fat. This has 3 grams of fat. And I always tell patients, look at the percent of calories from fat. If it's more than 30% from fat, it's a higher fat food. I would try and avoid it if you can, or eat very little of it. So you can see this is about 30% of calories from fat. We're going to look at saturated fat in particular, because you know that we want to avoid saturated and trans fats. We're going to look at the sodium. We know we have a limit on sodium. We're trying to eat less than 2,300 milligrams a day. And then we're going to look at total carbohydrate. And so I look at total carb, and I know 1 serving of carb is 15 grams. This is 13 grams, so it's about 1 serving of carb. I'm going to look at fiber. And when I think about fiber, I try and tell my patients, if it says 0 fiber, it's a processed food. It's a highly processed food. It doesn't have fiber in it. Try and go toward foods that say 3 grams or more of fiber. Even 2 grams is better than 0. But 3 grams, you're really getting some fiber intake. You can see that 3 grams is about 12% of your fiber needs. So it's not bad. Now sugars, this is complicated, but a lot of times, like if I look at a soda, I'll go right to the sugar because I know 1 teaspoon of sugar is 4 grams. So as I was, if there was 40 grams of sugar for a soda, that's 10 teaspoons of sugar. That's a lot. But sometimes foods have different, are more complex, and the sugar can be not just added sugar, but from the food itself. So I just kind of say take a look at this, but really what we want to focus on is total carbohydrate for the 1/2 cup. This 1/2 cup has 13 grams or 1 serving of carbohydrate. Okay, so we're going to look at fat, serving size, total carb. We're going to look at fiber, hoping there's some fiber in there, and we might take a look at sodium too if we're worried about sodium intake. And I do want to tell you there's a great app called Fugicate. I have it on my phone, and I go to the store and my kids want all that junk food cereal, and I'm like, you guys got to go evaluate the cereal with this app, and if it gets a B or better, we can get it. But it's really great for your patients too, because they can scan any food item and it gives you a caloric content and it gives it a nutrition rating. Let's do a poll question. You are teaching your patient about label reading. If the patient ate 2 servings of this macaroni and cheese, how much saturated fat would they be eating? Would they be eating A, 12 grams, B, 3 grams, C, 24 grams, or D, 6 grams? So I'm going to let you look at that for a minute. How much saturated fat would they be eating if they had 2 servings of this product? So I'm going to go ahead and launch the poll. I just can't put the picture on the poll question. So okay, looking good. Okay, I'll take a few more seconds. I'm sorry, I kind of closed it, but that's okay because we will do this together. So I'm just going to share your results and then we'll go over the answer together. 14% of you chose 24 grams and 86% of you chose 6 grams. The correct answer is D, 6 grams. So what I asked you, I got to move my thing over here. Hang on, let me hide this. Is how much saturated fat would they be eating? So here's total fat, 12 grams. The saturated fat is here, 3 grams. So there's 2 servings per container. So 2 times 3 grams is 6 grams of saturated fat. So I did put a juicy answer in there to lure you, the 24 grams, because what you were looking at was total fat and you doubled that. But this question said saturated fat. So that's what I want you to look at for that test question. So good, that just gives you information that says really read the question carefully And maybe double check it sometimes with these types of questions to make sure you're getting the right answer. So D was the right answer. Okay, we're going to do another one. Oh, okay. Hang on. I'm going to end. Shoot. Okay. You guys, don't look at the slide for a second. Poll question two. You are teaching your patient about label reading. I already did that one. Okay. Well, anyways, you are teaching your patient about counting fat. If the patient ate one serving of this macaroni and cheese, how many calories would come from total fat? Is it A, 12 calories, B, 108 calories, C, 27 calories, or D, 18%? If the patient's going to eat one serving of macaroni and cheese, how many calories would come from total fat with one serving? So I'm going to launch this poll. I have a feeling 100% of you are going to get this right. Yep, sorry. You know what? I tried to make that where it comes in after we go over the answer, but it came in already. So that was a little gift to all of you. Okay. Oh, okay. Well, maybe all of you didn't see it. Let me keep going here. Okay. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to close the poll. So, how many calories would come from total fat? This person is eating one serving. One serving is 12 grams. So to figure out total fat, we have to know a very important factor, and that is how many calories does fat give per gram? And as it turns out, fat has 9 kilocalories per gram. Is that important to know for the exam? You better believe it. I don't know if they're going to word a question like this, but I thought it was a really good way to see if you knew that there's 9 calories per gram of fat. So there's 12 grams of total fat times 9 kilocalories, which is what fat contains, equals 108. So in this product, out of the 250 calories, out of the 250 calories, 108 of them come from fat. Is that a low-fat dish meal? No, it's a high-fat meal. Okay, let's keep going. Thanks, everybody. So fat, from ADA 2015 standards, evidence is inconclusive for ideal amount of total fat intake for people with diabetes. Again, goals should be individualized, and fat quality appears to be far more important than quantity. So that's the quality more important than quantity. Some people could argue that, but that's what the ADA says. The amount of dietary saturated fat, cholesterol, and trans fat recommended as the same as a recommendation for the general population. Here it comes. So I was just mentioning that some people might have a different perspective, so leave that perspective behind and just focus on the ADA guidelines. This just comes from the ADA standards. I just read this the other day. People with diabetes on average get 45% of calories from carbs. You think it'd be higher, but it's not. 30 to 40% from fat and 16 to 18% from protein. And some of my colleagues are saying, and even the diabetes prevention program says eat less fat, lose weight. And you can see we're getting a lot of calories from fat, so maybe that's not a bad idea. And get more of our calories from whole grains, beans, fresh vegetables and fruit. That might be a nice switch to help our patients. But the ADA says limit saturated fats to less than 10%, limit trans fat as much as possible, and watch for dietary cholesterol less than 300 milligrams a day. So let's keep going. So fat, 9 calories per gram. Here's the monounsaturated, the healthy fats, kind of the darling of the fat world, are the healthy olive and canola, avocado. These lower total cholesterol and LDL. They raise HDL and they're high in omega-3 fatty acids. The polyunsaturated, lower total cholesterol and LDL. And then the unhealthy saturated fat comes from animals. So I tell my patients, if it had a mother, it has saturated fat in it. So those are the foods you want to eat less of. And then the plant products include palm coconut, palm kernel oil, These are fats solid at room temperature, like if you leave a pan of bacon out overnight, the next day it's white, you could write your name in it. Here's serving size. I try and think of fat as a condiment, really using it very conservatively if possible. Fat does serve a really important function. It makes us feel full, but too much of it can increase caloric intake. So unhealthy dietary fats, the trans fat, we want to avoid that. And here's where you would see it on the label. There's a strong link between diet high in trans fat and heart disease. Trans fat lowers good cholesterol, increases bad cholesterol, and it's just really, we want to avoid it. And actually, food manufacturers are, there's a lot less trans fat now in foods. You'll look at the label, it's really hard to find trans fats. But you want to look on the label and avoid foods that have hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated. Those are the bad kind of fats. Okay, protein recommendations. This is new for a lot of us, so put a big star by this. Diabetes and no diabetes kidney disease. Evidence is inconclusive for ideal amount of protein. Goals should be individualized. But let's look at the next one. Diabetes and kidney failure. Reducing the amount of dietary protein is not recommended. Does not improve outcomes. Wow, that's big. Because we used to always say, if they're in renal failure, eat less protein. But they've done some studies, the ADA, and they said, really, it doesn't seem to improve outcomes. So that no longer is a recommendation. I did put the recommended daily allowance of protein from the federal government just as a reference for all of you. It may come up on the exam. But just to be clear, the ADA says protein is individualized. The RDA does have this number, 0.8 grams of good quality protein per kilogram per day. It's kind of the recommended middle of the road place to be. Protein seems to stimulate insulin response. So I had a patient come in to see me and his provider told him, you know, eat peanut butter if your blood sugars are low. Well, that's not a really good recommendation because it has protein and fat together in it, and that might actually stimulate the release of insulin and slow the absorption of any carbohydrate. So, you know, we really want to educate our patients on the importance of treating with the right foods when they are low, have low blood sugar. So protein is 4 calories per gram, there's 9 calories per gram in fat, so you can see protein has about half the calories. But we want to choose the lean protein. And really, you know, we're talking about plant-based protein sources, really important, low-fat cheeses. And, you know, some of my patients, I'm even saying, have a, you know, meat-free Monday or something like that, because the new evidence is coming out that we may be over-consuming our protein. And that protein, it is a mixed food. It has saturated fat associated with it. So the serving size is not a 16-ounce steak. It's a 3-ounce steak, which is the size of a deck of cards. So let's keep talking about alcohol, weight, gastroparesis, and other factors. Alice has type 1 diabetes, drank 4 rum and Cokes. You can see through the night that got progressively bigger, and ate some snacks around 9 p.m. She took 3 units of insulin via her pump. At bedtime, her blood sugar is 162. Drinking alcohol puts Alice at risk for A, DKA due to ketone production associated with alcohol, B, hyperglycemia during the night due to gluconeogenesis, C, hyperglycemia from alcohol and appetizers, or D, hypoglycemia. Let me go ahead and launch this. All right, you guys are just way too smart for me. I had juicy answers. I put big words in there. I tried to lure you in, and nobody took the bait. Okay, I'm going to close the poll since you're just blasting through this and share with you. 100% of you chose the right answer, hypoglycemia. Yes, that is the right answer. So even though her blood glucose is 162, and even though she ate snack and Coke, rum and Cokes, we know with type 1 diabetes, very high risk for hypoglycemia after ingestion of alcohol. Alcohol blocks the release of glucose from the liver, and so there might be insulin running in her system from the insulin pump, and there's not enough sugar to interact with that insulin, so she gets hypoglycemia. So I do tell my people with type 1 diabetes on insulin, every drink you have, associate it with 15 grams of carbohydrate. Very, very important to help prevent hypoglycemia. And really, if they can, you know, at all, not to drink too much, because hypoglycemia and drunkenness imitate each other. So your friends may think you're just drunk and don't understand you're hypoglycemic. So conversations, frank ones about this are really important, especially for, you know, people who are drinking or people at risk or doing high-risk behaviors. For women, the American Diabetes Association says drink one or fewer alcoholic drinks a day. For men, two or fewer alcoholic drinks a day. And this is what one alcohol drink equals. So it's not a lot. So patients need to understand it's not a 40-ounce, you know, bottle of beer. That's not one serving. It's a 12-ounce beer. If drink limit amount and eat food, and it can really cause hypoglycemia and worsen neuropathy. People with diabetes do drink, so we want to help them drink safely. So successful weight loss strategies. We know that losing weight early in diabetes can protect beta cells. So here's some things that can help people lose weight. Eating breakfast, eat less fast food. If you're doing it 7 times, go to 5 times a week. Decrease portion size, get active, use meal replacements, and really focus on healthy foods. To lose weight, the optimal macronutrient intake is not known. And the literature doesn't support one particular way to lose weight, but rather a spectrum of eating patterns that result in reduced energy intake. And this is good to know, too. To lose 1 pound, you have to deprive yourself, I use the word avoid, but really deprive yourself of 3,500 calories. 1 pound is equivalent to 3,500 calories. And that means decreasing your intake by about a sandwich a day, plus exercise to maintain weight loss. But the American Diabetes Association does note that losing 2 to 8 kilograms, which is about 5 to 18 pounds, early in the diagnosis of type 2 does help protect beta cells. The American Diabetes Association also recognizes that bariatric surgery may be an option for some of our patients. Here's a reason why, where they make a smaller stomach pouch and they reconnect the duodenum, they reconnect the stomach, skipping the duodenum and going to the jejunum. And so when you bypass the duodenum, you're going to absorb a lot less nutrients. And so that's how patients lose weight. They have a smaller stomach pouch, plus they're bypassing the duodenum and they absorb less of their nutrients. But as you can imagine, there are some things they need to replace to make up for those lost nutrients too. So they need some supplements to make up for that. But we do consider bariatric surgery for adults with a BMI of 35 or greater. Post-bariatric surgery, you'll notice that their gut hormone levels increase. So gut hormone levels really double after bariatric surgery, which helps to lower blood sugars. They need lifelong support and monitoring. And so this thing about remission. So a lot of times patients will say, I'm going to have bariatric surgery and cure my diabetes. Well, bariatric surgery does not cure the diabetes. You may go into remission. And remission is defined as blood glucose levels are normal without medications. So if you gain that weight back, you have the chance of your blood sugars going right back up. So there's a 68% remission within 5 years, but 35% redevelop diabetes over 5 years. So it isn't a cure, but we definitely know it does help lower blood sugars, and long-term benefits are still under investigation. And somebody just asked me, why does alcohol cause neuropathy? I don't know if I can fully answer that question. I don't know if it's fully known. It worsens neuropathy, and it might be because of some B12 deficiencies associated with chronic alcohol intake, and people get a lot of malnutrition from chronic alcohol intake, and it just worsens neuropathic pain. So we don't always know the why, but I think that's a great idea for you to look up and see if you can get some more information on that. That would be excellent. Celiac disease. So celiac disease is another complication associated mostly with type 1 diabetes. It's an autoimmune reaction to gluten. So here's the normal villi of the intestines. They're able to grab nutrients and bring it down into the lamina propria for absorption by the intestine. But here's when you have celiac disease. The villi are inflamed. There's no absorption on the surface of the intestine because the villi can't bring in the nutrients. I would say not no absorption, but a lot less absorption. So it's really considered a malabsorption manifestation. These patients will have weight loss, fatty stools, diarrhea, muscle tenderness, failure to thrive. So I've had lots of patients with type 1, and then they get this gastroparesis later in life in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and they can't figure out why they're losing weight, why their blood sugars are so wacky. So we're always on the lookout for patients with developing celiac disease. How do we diagnose it? Well, usually we measure transglutaminase levels. And if those are elevated to confirm diagnosis, they have to do a biopsy. We don't always do a biopsy, but most times it is required, and they need to see a GI specialist to confirm diagnosis. There will be questions on celiac disease on the exam. So be familiar with it, but also more than the exam, we want to be on the lookout for our patients too, who might be experiencing it and not diagnosed. So they need to avoid wheat, barley, and rye. Definitely referral to the dietitian who's familiar with this is important, and then helping them understand, you know, which foods have gluten, and it's complicated. But now there's new labeling laws, so they have to label food packages to say if it's gluten-free or not. But I have many friends with celiac disease, and they have to read labels very carefully. Gluten is hidden in many, many different food types. So these are just a few of them that you wouldn't even think about. Communion wafers, thickeners, you know, marinades, imitation seafood, all over the place. So it's really a lifelong avoidance of gluten, which is a challenge. Let's do another poll question. John has gastroparesis and is struggling with bloating and nausea after meal. What is the best recommendation? Is it A, eat raw vegetables and limit fruit? Is it B, eat low fiber small meals? Is it C, always take insulin after meals? Or is it D, avoid foods containing wheat? What is the right answer? Okay. I'm going to close this. Thank you for voting, everybody, and share it with you. So nobody said eat raw vegetables and limit fruit. Great. 93% of you said eat low fiber, small meals. And here I am talking about fiber ad nauseam, how important it is. And now we're going to tell a patient to eat low fiber. That is the right answer, because high fiber meals slow the absorption of the nutrients and can clog up the stomach even more than it's already clogged up. And so we ask them to eat low fiber. Many of my patients with gastroparesis, I have them drink liquid nutrient first before eating their regular meal, just to make sure their blood sugars don't plummet. And so we just have to work with the gastroparesis and the best we can, and really work on getting the blood sugars down. As we get the blood sugars down, the stomach can improve its functionality. That's really the best fix. One of the best fixes is lowering blood sugars, but we need to support them in the meantime. Now, 7% of you chose C, and I kind of put C in there as a juicy answer, so thank you for choosing it so I could talk about it. But always take insulin after meals. So the word that tells us this is the wrong answer is the word always, because that cannot be the case for everyone with gastroparesis. It is true that for a lot of my patients with gastroparesis, I will tell them to take insulin after their meals to match the time when their food is being absorbed, but we can't say always for all patients. So if you ever see the word always, be very suspect. It's usually not the right answer. So I'm going to go ahead and hide this. But the right answer is to eat low-fiber small meals. That is always the right answer. But I didn't put the word always before it. Anyways, I won't get complicated on that, but that is the right answer. Gastroparesis affects 20 to 30% of people with long-standing diabetes. They're going to complain of nausea, early satiety, after they take like the hallmark sign for me is they give insulin and then after meals they keep getting hypoglycemia. I know they're probably getting it because the food is still in their in their stomach and not reaching their intestines. So it's a real strong sign. Postprandial hypoglycemia, vomiting. How do we diagnose it? Well, you can do gastric emptying study, but also we can, base it on symptoms of the patient. The treatment, improve blood sugar, small, low fat and low fiber meals, and sometimes we'll use medications to also help propel the stomach contents forward. Let's do another poll question. Joan has type 1 diabetes, teaches aerobics, and she has a BMI of 17. Her fasting blood glucose is 312 to 380s. Which is most important intervention to help her improve her diabetes control? Is it A, eat a 15-gram carb snack before teaching class? Is it B, acknowledge this hyperglycemia signifies the end of the honeymoon period? Is it C, referral to mental health professional? Or is it D, increase her basal insulin dose? Let me go ahead and launch that poll. Thanks for voting, everybody. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close this. Thank you. So this is a tricky question, and let's talk about it for a few minutes. Joan has type 1 diabetes. She teaches aerobics, and she has a BMI of 17. So this BMI is really important in the right answer for this test because, as you know, if you think about BMI, a BMI of 17 is underweight. And so we're getting some information. She's doing aerobics. She's underweight. Her fasting blood sugar is very high. Which is the most important intervention to help her improve her diabetes? So I want to. Oh, you're viewing parts of that. So no one chose A. That's great. So some of you chose B. Acknowledge this hyperglycemia signifies the end of the honeymoon period. Yeah, probably not. That's not the right answer, and I'll tell you why. Because it doesn't say Jonah's had type 1 for a year. It doesn't give you any time frame, and the end of the honeymoon usually is within a year or so. So that's not the right answer. 53% of you chose the right answer, referral to mental health professional, because when I see this situation, when the patient is exercising a lot and BMI is very low and blood sugars are elevated, those three really signal to me that they might have an eating disorder. So C is the better answer than D. We don't get any information about her insulin basal dose. It's never even mentioned in the case study. So that seems like an unlikely answer. So again, it gets to this place of the best answer given the information you have. And so C is the right answer. Refer to a mental health professional. So good job, you all. And disordered eating is a common occurrence with type 1 diabetes. Most more with girls, but also with boys. The term is diabulimia, and that is people with type 1 diabetes give themselves less insulin than needed, and they do this to lose weight. So they have disordered eating. It tends to start in adolescence, more likely to occur in women than men. Signs: unexplainable spikes in blood sugar or A1C, weight loss, lack of mark from finger pricks, so they're not really checking their blood sugar. And then you might want to look at their prescription refills for their insulin. And if they bring in their records and their blood sugars look normal, but their A1C is elevated. So we're just on the lookout for this because it is a devastating condition and people can die from this. We want to identify it early on and get them to a mental health professional. It's really, really important. Oh, Joan wants to know, is teaching aerobics considered exercising a lot? So, Joan, you're right. I mean, she may be a healthy, lean person. There are a lot of healthy, lean type 1s. I totally get that. But I do want to say, in her situation, a BMI of 17 and the blood sugar is so high, given this information and the answers that were listed there, that was the best answer. So I agree. It's more complex than I put in that little poll question. But I want to bring it up, and I want us to be aware of it because I think it's easy to miss. So you want to know these facts for the exam. Fat is 9 calories, carb 4, protein 4 calories per gram. You want to know common food carbohydrate counts. We want to know milk is 12 grams of carb. 1 pound is 3,500 calories. 10,000 steps is the recommended step you want to take per day. And 2,000 steps equals a mile. So those are some really good facts to know. And I do want to say, this is not on the exam, I do want to talk about the 2015 Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee report. So this is a guideline for the federal government, and what was suggested to the federal government is the following, and that eat more plant-based foods, less sugar and meat, and a plant-focused diet not only promotes health, but is also more environmentally sustainable. Wow. Include a broad range of foods, including fruits, veggies, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, as well as fish and low-fat dairy. So the new guidelines are now are up for comment. Well, these guidelines are up for comment, and maybe in 2016 we'll get the final guidelines. So very interesting shift in what we used to say from the national or federal government. Okay, so in our last 20 minutes, we're going to talk about physical activity. I might go a little bit over depending on how the flow goes. I don't want to rush. That's really doesn't help too much, so I want to make sure I cover this information in a way that's meaningful for you. Physical activity. So here's what we need to know about physical activity. That's from the CDE exam outline. All children should be encouraged to engage in 60 minutes of physical activity a day. That's kids. Adults with diabetes, 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity aerobic physical activity spread over at least 3 days. Don't miss more than 2 consecutive days of exercise. So that's important because exercise affects blood sugar for 24 to 48 hours. So if you go more than 2 days, you lose the benefit. You just want to at least every other day. It would be great if people could do that. And in absence of contraindications, type 2 should engage in resistance training, weightlifting, 2 times a week. So how do we define physical activity? Well, physical activity is kind of just body movement that requires more energy than when resting. Exercise is planned and structured physical activity like this that includes repetitive body movements. Sedentary behavior are these two boys right here. Little or no movement or physical activity. What are the benefits? You know the benefits. Improve blood sugars. You know, I've mentioned this before, but muscles take up 85% of the glucose in our blood. So the more muscle mass we have, the more sugar we utilize and burn, and we just feel better. It reduces cardiovascular risk, maintains weight loss. Exercise cannot usually be credited for weight loss, but exercise will help you maintain it. Slows decline in mobility. Keep your body moving. Look at this lady. She's, I don't know, in her 70s maybe, swimming. Look at, she's glowing. She looks beautiful and healthy. And, you know, you see people who are physically active. They just have a disposition of better health. Exercise is a vital component of prevention as well as management of type 2. And maybe it will have the greatest impact and improving those abnormalities of insulin resistance when started early. And it can help stop IR, stands for insulin resistance, from progressing to diabetes. Catch it early. Get active. Use your muscles. Type 1 emphasis is different. We want to focus on helping adjust insulin to allow for safe activity. So type 1s have a more difficult balancing act, reducing their insulin in anticipation of activity, or maybe trying to eat more food if they weren't able to anticipate that physical activity. So type 2 is a little more straightforward. Type 1s need a lot more fine-tuning and problem-solving. The other thing that's really important is this progressive resistant exercise. It said earlier, 2 times a week, do some type of weight training. Examples include exercise with free weights or weight machines, or you can use these bands. So these bands are, they increase muscle resistance and will build muscle mass. So these bands might be really helpful for a lot of our patients who don't want to carry weights around. and that can have access to these, especially if they can see a physical therapist and get some training on this. As educators, I believe that we need to be more familiar with teaching patients about resistance exercising, and I'm gonna commit to writing a newsletter on this because I'm not familiar with it. I've lifted weights in my life, but I don't have any expertise in that area, and so I'm looking to gaining expertise so I can share it with my patients. Each session should consist of at least one set of five or more resistant exercises using large muscle groups. So using a low weight but a lot of repetitions is what the goal is. Let's do another poll question. According to the ADA guidelines, who needs a graded exercise test with EKG? Is it a 25-year-old overweight female diabetes for 5 years? Is it a 30-year-old male with type 2 diabetes, BMI of 31? Is it a 38-year-old male, type 1 for 10 years, history of retinopathy? Or a 38-year-old obese woman with a history of GDM? Who needs a graded exercise test with EKG before they start exercising, according to ADA guidelines? All right. Thank you for voting, everyone. This type of question has appeared on the exam, so I wanted to present it to you. Something to be familiar with. But I'm going to say the same thing. It's great to be familiar for the exam, but also in our practice. Who should we ask to get an exercise test, an EKG? All of our patients, or maybe just the high-risk ones. I'm going to go ahead and close this. So according to the American Diabetes Association, who needs a graded exercise, stress test with EKG? Of these people, who is at most risk for vascular disease? And I will tell you, and I'm going to share this with you. C is the right answer. 67% of you chose that. And why C is the right answer is that they've had diabetes for more than 10 years and they have a history of retinopathy. So anybody with a history of retinopathy is more likely to have vascular disease. That's really important to know. And anybody with a history of retinopathy, which, retinopathy is new blood vessels growing in your eye, so it signifies serious vessel disease. We're going to need to talk about safety precautions as far as lifting weights, bending over also. That's going to be part of our conversation. But of all of these people, C meets the target, and I'm going to go over that with you now. So pre-exercise evaluation for type 2. In asymptomatic patients, routine screening is not recommended. So, we have a regular patient, no history of heart disease, and I don't know what a regular patient is, but overweight type 2 who comes in. As long as their cardiovascular risk factors are treated, we can just do, walking a half hour a day is certainly an appropriate intervention. But we do want to assess their cardiovascular risk factors annually, and candidates for advanced or invasive cardiac testing include that they have any cardiac symptoms or if they had abnormal resting electrocardiogram. We're going to do further testing. But for most of our patients, just some basic walking is okay unless they have some coronary issues. Pre-exercise evaluation. Use clinical judgment when making physical activity suggestions and check in with a provider if unsure. This is important because if you're not sure, you want to really talk to the provider and make sure your suggestions are appropriate. Encourage high-risk patients to start with low intensity and short time. Increase duration and intensity slowly. And this is where we're going to reach out to our colleagues who are physical therapists and get feedback from them too. I mean, we have a lot of expertise that people have with a lot of expertise that we can reach out to. Contraindications for certain types of exercise include uncontrolled hypertension, severe autonomic or peripheral neuropathy, history of foot lesions, unstable proliferative retinopathy. Patient with complications require a more thorough assessment. So any of these patients, we really need to do some cardiac stress testing. In general, EKG stress testing may be indicated for individuals with matching one or more of the criteria. So you can read through all of these, but you can see down here that if they have proliferative or preproliferative retinopathy with type 1 diabetes more than 10 years in duration, we certainly want to do some stress testing. Thank you. So you can take a look at these and be familiar with this as far as the exam and who is considered high risk. So that is a helpful tool to take a look at. And I have this article, I got a lot of this information from this consensus statement that you can go ahead and take a look at too. Patients to discuss symptoms with provider before starting exercise. So if your patient, of course, is complaining of chest pain, shortness of breath, leg cramps that go away with rest, which is intermittent claudication, so you know they're having some PAD, peripheral arterial disease, not good circulation. If they're having head, shoulder, neck, and or back aches that are unexplained, these are patients that I'm definitely going to have a conversation with the provider about and kind of give them a heads up that the patient is complaining of this and what type of exercise should we start with, or maybe we hold off before and have an assessment done first. Let's do another poll question. Let's talk more about exercise. What best describes normal hormone response during exercise? Is it A, insulin and counter-regulatory hormones are suppressed? Is it B, insulin levels are increased, gluconeogenesis is decreased? Is it C, insulin action is suppressed and there's increased gluconeogenesis? Or is it D, increase in insulin, uptake of glycogen? So this is, what is a normal hormonal response during exercise? This is not diabetes. So this, on the exam, they have asked questions about normal hormonal responses during exercise. So you want to know those, what happens during exercise, and those without diabetes and those with diabetes. You want to be familiar with that. Okay, thank you for voting, everybody. I can really tell, I want to be honest, that you all are getting ready for the exam. I mean, you're making great progress. I'm proud of you. I'm going to close the poll and share with you. So this may be some new language for you. You may not be familiar with exercise and the physiology, so let's go over this together. Nobody chose insulin levels. Or A, insulin and counter-regulatory hormones are suppressed. Right, because when you exercise, you increase your counter-regulatory hormones. That's why a lot of people say, hey, when I exercise, my blood sugars go up for a little while. That's because when you exercise, you do release stress hormones. So A was not the right answer. B, insulin levels increase, gluconeogenesis decreases. No, that's not the right answer. So let's think about exercise. When you're exercising, you need more glucose and you suppress insulin. So that's not the right answer. So you just have to think, when I exercise, my muscles need sugar. How do my muscles get sugar? It increases gluconeogenesis. So C is the right answer. Insulin action is suppressed, increased gluconeogenesis. So normally when we exercise, insulin levels are suppressed and then we make more sugar available to our muscle. D, some of you chose that, increase in insulin, uptake of glycogen. No, that's not the right answer. So C is the right answer. If you didn't know this, that's okay. You just want to read about exercise and the normal hormonal responses and kind of think about it. So in this question, I put a lot of big words purposely. I put a lot of, you know, glycogen, gluconeogenesis, counter-regulatory hormones, and on the exam, they're going to do that too. Don't be distracted by big words and, you know, all these fancy terms. Just break it down. Gluconeogenesis, what does that mean? Making of new genesis, making of new glucose. Oh, that makes sense. Glycogen, storage of glucose. So that's, yeah, that's not right. And then counter-regulatory hormones, you know, those are the stress hormones. So So just break down the words and just take it one at a time. And if you're not sure, just get rid of wrong answers, and then you'll see one or two best answers that are left. Okay. Exercise effects on blood glucose. No diabetes. Insulin action is suppressed. Counterregulatory hormones release stored glycogen from muscle and liver. There's an increase in gluconeogenesis. So now you've used up your glycogen stores in your liver and in your muscle, so it takes up to 48 hours to replace those stores. So this is really important. People need to replace the energy they burned for exercise. And that comes to play with diabetes because they are at risk for hypoglycemia for a day, up to a day afterward of a serious exercise situation. Let's look at type 1 hormone response now. This is a person with type 1. Now, they're going to use this word a lot in the exam, exogenous and endogenous insulin. So exogenous insulin just means insulin injected from the outside. That's what it means, injected insulin. Endogenous insulin is the insulin we make from our own cells. Hormone response in type 1. So they inject insulin through a pump or through an injection, so they can't take that back. So the insulin is still floating around from the insulin they gave earlier. When they exercise, they are more insulin sensitive and they increase insulin absorption. This should say increased glucose absorption, actually. So that's a little, I need to fix that, but they have increased insulin sensitivity and increased glucose absorption. So what is this group at risk for? You're right, hypoglycemia. So what strategies to stay safe before, during, and after? So a person with type 1 diabetes is going to have to check their blood sugar before they exercise. They might, if they're on a pump, have to downregulate their basal rate during exercise. Or if they're on injections, they're going to have to think ahead and take a little bit less insulin before they exercise. During exercise, they're going to have to maybe stop and monitor their blood sugar. And after exercise, depending on what their blood sugar is, they may have to replace the glucose they burned up. So they may need to have a snack. Most times they will. And I have a little table that will look at how much carbohydrate do they need to cover that exercise bout. But let's take a look now at our type 2s. Our type 2s have decreased secretion of endogenous insulin. So their insulin levels go down. They have a res since they make endogenous insulin, it's shut down during exercise. They are more insulin sensitive and they have increased glucose disposal, so they're going to burn up a lot more sugar. So this group is at less risk for hypoglycemia because their body can regulate a little bit and make less insulin. But what if this group is on medications that lower blood sugar, like, for example, sulfonylureas? Or what if they're taking insulin injections? Then, just like the type 1, they're going to have to be more thoughtful about planning exercise and monitoring their blood sugar more closely. So we want to check blood sugars before exercise if they're on insulin or secretagogue, and monitor, after. And I don't know if they're going to check as much as a type 1, but they're going to just have to become. Actually, what I would do for these patients is I would say when you're starting to exercise, check more frequently, and then we'll get a feel for how you respond, and then we can develop a plan for the future so you don't have to check as much before, during, and after. So type 1, the hypoglycemic risk is because activity increases exogenous insulin sensitivity and may block the breakdown of glycogen. Type 2s, same concern as above if on insulin or sulfonylureas, but they're really low risk if treated by diet, exercise, or medications that don't cause hypo. So I hope that makes sense to everybody. So these groups are more high risk, more planning involved if they're on insulin. So duration of hypoglycemic risk. During exercise, they're at risk. Immediately after, and post-exercise late onset hypoglycemia, more often in type 1s, often at night. So you can see their glycogen stores have not been replenished, so their body is storing the sugar. So the sugar leaves the blood, it goes into the muscle and the liver, and they don't have enough glucose circulating in their blood. So they're going to have to monitor their blood sugars closely, especially if they start a new exercise program. And this is more true for moderate to high intensity exercise of more than 30 minutes. So we just monitor them 4 to 15 hours after an exercise session that's, you know, more intense. So preventing hypoglycemia, we want to, if there's a planned activity, adjust insulin in anticipation, reduce insulin post-exercise period, frequent monitoring, and keep logs. Like I was saying earlier, we want to help patients determine how exercise affects them. And then they want to make sure to carry a fast-acting carbohydrate. And if they have type 1 diabetes, we need to make sure they have a glucagon emergency kit. They might need some carbohydrate after exercise, and watch out. This is after you exercise, don't go to the bar and, you know, drink those rum and cokes, because then you really potentiate hypoglycemia. And I have some snack ideas. I love these little raisins in a box. They're so great to carry around in your car, in your purse, by your desk, at your nightstand, in case you get low. And I have these little juice boxes too. You know, these they're not healthy for you, I know that, but the little juice boxes in the foil, really easy to transport and cart around with you in case of low. So adjusting carbohydrate prior to planned activity, you might need a 15-gram snack if you're using insulin and your blood sugar is less than 100. If your blood sugar is 120, you probably don't need a snack, but if it's under 100, that's a really good thing to know for the exam. If it's under 100, have the snack. And I've had this little chart, Compliments of Dana Armstrong, where it says carbohydrate replacement during physical activity. And it's rated by duration and intensity. So you can take a look at that chart. And that's just really good to know for our patients and, you know, for the exam. So what about hyperglycemia? Do our type 1s, can they get hyperglycemic during exercise? Yeah, they can. If there's not enough insulin on board and they make excessive stress hormones, this is a fine line for our type 1s to figure out how much insulin do I need with exercise. But as we've mentioned, exercise can increase stress hormones, which make you more insulin resistant. And so they're at risk for hyper. High intensity exercises and competitive sports really exacerbate this. So we need to make sure that they have adequate insulin and just doing a lot of log and problem solving. Who needs to test their ketones? Well, type 1s, if their blood glucose is more than 240, they want to test their ketones. And this is to show, I mean, this is really important before exercise, because if a type 1, even if their blood sugar is, you know, 250, but they're ketone positive always signifies insulin deficiency. And so if they're ketone positive, we know don't exercise, it can worsen hyperglycemia and ketosis. If there's negative ketones, you can go ahead and exercise as long as you keep adequately hydrated, and they might need a little bit of insulin. But for our type 2s, we only check if they're more than 300 and above. So even a type 2, if they're 300 and their ketones are negative, they can go walking. It's okay. That will help get their blood sugars down. Just really, really keep hydrated in both situations. And just to wrap up, I want to do one more poll question. And we talk about behavior goals and learning objectives. So I want to see if we can differentiate between a behavior goal and a learning objective. So here's poll question 9. Which of the following is a learning objective? Record your food intake for 1 month, A. B. Identify carbohydrate food each meal. C. Drink non-caloric beverages instead of soda. Or D. Eat 3 servings of carb at dinner. So which one of these is a learning objective? Oh, I didn't launch it yet. Sorry. I thought I did. I know, we're just going to be like 1 minute over, so I really appreciate you sticking with me. Okay. I'm impressed. I'm seriously impressed right now. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share it with you. So when we think about a learning objective versus a behavior objective, a behavioral objective is actually, you know, doing an action. And all of these are action except for B, identify carbohydrate food each meal. That's not a behavior change. It's a learning objective. So B is the right answer, and 92% of you got that right. Great job. They might ask you a question about that on the exam too. So just be kind of clear what learning objective is. It's more understanding a concept versus a behavior objective, which is actually taking action. It's a fine line, but it's you know, you want to be familiar with that. So guess what? We still have two more sessions. And I want to say this session 6 has about 60 test questions. So you're going to be so excited when you go online to the online university. You're going to see there's 60 test questions. They're actually, I gathered all the poll questions I've asked you in the past, and I put them on this exam. And I changed some of the answers around so you can still, you know, think about these and figure out the right answer. We have changed the behavior change and coping webcast to April 29th. Some of you were taking the exam the first week of May, and so I'm going to get it in April 29th. I'm teaching at Concord the next day, but I said, girl, you could do it. Our test taking practice will be Monday, April 27th. I'm going to send you a test later today. If you could take that test, I'm going to send you a PDF version, or you go to our online university. That will be great. There's 48 questions. And what I'm going to do at our next session is I'm going to just go over as many test questions as I can in an hour and just say, okay, let's get to the right answer and figure out how to get to the right answer of these different test questions. So it's a test question taking webcast. Yeah. So it's intense, but it's helpful for some people. My last bootcamp group asked me to do that for them, and I said, okay, I'll throw that in, and it just seemed to reassure them that they were getting to the right answer most of the time. So this wraps up our 6th bootcamp, and I'm going to hang out for questions afterward. Just remember, when I shut the recording, it takes me like a 10 to 30 seconds to get my audio back, but I am still here. So thank you so much for joining us for the 6th boot camp. And as always, if you have any questions, I'm available and I will get back to you. Sometimes it takes me longer than other times depending on my workload, but your questions are really important to me and I want to be a resource for you. So this is Beverly Tomasian signing off. Thank you so much, everyone.